If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Francisco and KQEI, North Highlands, Sacramento. And we're online, too, at kqed.org. Or just ask your smart speaker, your smart device, to play KQED using those words.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, would you erase or manipulate a painful memory if you could? In groundbreaking experiments with mice, neuroscientist Steve Ramirez has succeeded in turning memories on and off, even implanting false ones, calling to mind films like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or Blade Runner.
Those aren't your memories, they're somebody else's.
Ramirez says that soon we'll be able to do the same in humans, but should we? We look at the ethical questions and Ramirez's sudden loss of a friend that made him want to alter his memories. His new book is How to Change a Memory. Join us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. President Trump is proposing a $12 billion aid package for U.S. farmers who are affected by his trade war. Drew Hawkins of the Gulf States Newsroom has discussed Trump's plan with some farmers who are struggling to stay in business.
The people I talk to, what they want is they want Congress to stop playing politics, is how they put it. Speaker Johnson's district is very rural, lots of poverty, and a lot of people will be impacted if these subsidies go away without some sort of plan. And I think maybe the best way I can sum it up is a conversation I had with Susie Halley this past weekend. She's a Republican, she supports President Trump, and she runs a food bank in a place called Farmerville in Union Parish, which is in House Speaker Mike Johnson's district. And I asked her if she had a message for Speaker Johnson, and what she said was to fix it. She says people are already struggling to pay health insurance premiums already, right now. So if the subsidies go away, it'll only make it even harder for them.
Drew Hawkins reporting. 12 former FBI agents are suing the Bureau, alleging they were recently fired for kneeling at a racial justice protest 5 years ago. NPR's Kerry Johnson has the story.
The new lawsuit filed in federal court in Washington says the FBI agents did not have training in crowd control. They lacked helmets, riot shields, and other equipment when they were confronted by some hostile crowd members at a racial justice protest in June 2020. To defuse the situation, FBI agents closest to the crowd took a knee. They were investigated over the matter years ago, but nothing happened. Then, after new leaders joined the Bureau this year, they were investigated again and fired for unprofessional conduct, shortcutting the formal discipline process. Now those 12 former agents are asking for back pay and to return to their jobs. The FBI declined comment, citing pending litigation. Kerry Johnson, NPR News.
The Justice Department says it's detained three men accused of involvement in schemes to illegally send high-end microchips to China. NPR's John Ruwitch reports.
The DOJ says one man arrested in Texas pleaded guilty to smuggling and unlawful export activities. Unsealed court documents show that from October 2024 to May of this year, the man allegedly exported or attempted to export at least $160 million worth of NVIDIA H100 and H200 chips. Both are used in AI and other high-performance computing, and both have been under export controls as part of U.S. government efforts to help the United States retain its lead in AI. The DOJ announced that two other men were also arrested on similar charges. All three men could face steep fines and prison sentences of up to 10 or 20 years. The news comes as President Trump says he's prepared to allow the sale of H200 chips to China under conditions that, quote, allow for continued strong national security. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump last week said he favored the release of video showing a boat strike killing two survivors of a previous attack off Venezuela. Trump now says he'll leave that decision up to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who says his department is reviewing the information. The administration says that dozens of people who've been killed in U.S. strikes on small boats in the Caribbean and East Pacific were trying to transport narcotics to the United States. Hollywood's award season has kicked off with nominations for the Golden Globes. Details from NPR's Manalita Del Barco.
The dark comedy action thriller One Battle After Another picked up 9 Golden Globes nominations, including for director Paul Thomas Anderson and actors Chase Infinity, Benicio Del Toro, Sean Penn, Tiana Taylor, and Leonardo DiCaprio, who stars as a washed-up revolutionary.
Viva la revolución!
Among the film dramas competing for Golden Globes is the Norwegian comedy Sentimental Value and Ryan Coogler's period horror Sinners, with 7 nominations, including for actor Michael B. Jordan, who plays twin brothers.
Be careful. I will.
Comedian Nikki Glaser will once again host the ceremony, which will be held in Beverly Hills on January 11th. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Paramount Global has launched a hostile $108 billion bid to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery. The move comes a week after Netflix announced a deal to buy Warner Brothers and HBO. President Trump has applauded the changes that Paramount owner Larry Ellison has made since acquiring CBS and says he's reviewing any new deal. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
This week in KQED's Political Breakdown newsletter, Guy Marzorati looks at how Democrats are working to make health care a defining issue in next year's midterms, all the way down to the candidates they recruit. That's in our Political Breakdown newsletter. Find it at kqed.org. Mostly clear at the coast and bay shoreline overnight, partly to mostly cloudy with areas of fog inland, though lows 30s to upper 40s. Tuesday, partly cloudy, areas of fog in the morning, then becoming sunny. Highs 50s to mid-60s.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The science of memory manipulation is farther along than you might think. Scientists have been able to weaken or erase memories, even implant new or false ones with mice, inspiring sci-fi storylines and films and series like Severance.
I acknowledge that henceforth my access to my memories will be spatially dictated. I will be unable to access outside recollections whilst on Lumen's severed basement floor, nor retain work memories upon my ascent.
My guest, neuroscientist Steve Ramirez, has played a big role in moving forward memory manipulation in hopes of transforming the treatment of brain disorders. He's written a book about it and about the events in his life that caused him to think about changing his own memories. It's called How to Change a Memory, One Neuroscientist's Quest to Alter the Past. He joins me now. Welcome to Forum, Steve.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Really glad to have you. So where does the science of memory manipulation stand? Can you bring us up to speed generally on what scientists have successfully been able to do?
Yeah, the short of it, and I don't think it's too much of a spoiler here to say that the answer on how to change a memory is to recall it, to remember the thing that you're trying to change. It's one thing that we've learned from the last decades of neuroscience research is that memory, it might feel like a video recording of the past that you take on your phone that you can rewind to again and again, but it's much more dynamic and much more like a save as file on a Word document, for example, where memory is much more flexible, changeable, dynamic than we expected, especially when we recall a memory is when those changes begin to take place. The point being now that you can either let change happen naturally or have some goal that perhaps that change is to restore health or well-being to an individual, for example.
Yeah. So to that end, you can do things like selectively target and erase specific memories?
In mice, yes. And in flies, in mice, in rats, for example, some of our model organisms that we use in the lab, it's certainly possible nowadays to find the brain cells that hold on to an individual memory and then to tinker with those brain cells to stimulate them to see if that activates the memory or to quiet those cells down to quiet the memory itself so that it won't pop back up. In humans, it's a little more difficult because on the one hand, we certainly don't know how to
bona fide erase a memory in the human brain. But to recall one, that part is actually a bit straightforward, because I can just ask you, what did you have for dinner last night? How was it celebrating your last birthday party, and so on? So in that case, it depends on what our goal is, if it's to share a story via memory or to try to actually change the contents of a memory for therapeutic purposes, for example. In mice, it's certainly possible. In humans, the psychology behind it is a little bit trickier.
Right. And as you know very well, it's very possible to implant memories in mice. Can you tell us about how you have been able to artificially activate a memory and implant a new or false memory in them? How you did
that? Yeah, absolutely. It was, I started as a graduate student in MIT in 2010, joining Susumu Tonegawa's lab. And the lab had this overarching mission of understanding the science of how we learn and how we remember the past. And at that time, I teamed up with my late friend and day-to-day mentor, Xu Lu, who was designing the genetic engineering trickery needed to be able to find memories specifically in the rodent brain. So Xu and I teamed up rather quickly when I joined the lab, and we had this collective goal of finding the cells that hold on to one memory in the brain, and then somehow tricking just those cells to turn on so that we could test if that was enough to activate the memory itself. And Xu had developed a host of tools that we could use to try to find these brain cells, and we were somewhat shocked that the first big experiment that we did, which was in 2011, ended up working. And with that experiment, the gist of it was that Xu had developed tools where we could go in and find the brain cells that held on to one memory. And the first part was to trick them to glow green, for example, so that we could literally visualize them. We could see the cells that held on to one memory glowing in the brain. And the second part of that trick was then to activate those brain cells, which we were able to do with a technique called optogenetics, with opto meaning light and genetics meaning genetics, that we could go in and genetically trick these cells to be activatable with lasers in this case. And that was our million-dollar experiment, because when we found the cells that held on to just one memory and then used lasers to nudge those cells back awake to turn them back on, that remarkably caused the memory to come back. So it was our first demonstration of being able to artificially activate one specific memory in the rodent brain. And since then, the last decade and a couple of years has really been, I think, nothing short of a revolution in memory research with regards to activating, changing the contents, erasing or suppressing memories of all sorts.
And if I'm summarizing it correctly, basically, a mouse had a bad memory in one box. You put that mouse in a completely different box where it had no bad memories and was happily scampering around. And then you activated that bad memory from a previous box, even though it hadn't had it, in the one it was in now, and it froze in total fear.
That's exactly what we did in that first experiment. And I want to say that we started off in this case by trying to induce that freezing behavior. It's that kind of like, if you were to hear a loud noise right now, most of us would stay locked in place for a few seconds, and then fight or flight kicks in, because it's a behavioral measure that we can use that lets us know whether the animal is recalling that particular negative experience or not. So when the animal's in a safe environment, for instance, it's scurrying around, sniffing the corners, exploring this new environment. But when we reactivate that negative memory, the animal stops in place and freezes in place for as long as we're activating those brain cells. So we wanted to start off with the most straightforward behavioral measure we could get to test whether or not we were activating a memory. Because if that worked, then we could now extend this work to all sorts of more complex memories.
Yeah. Let me invite listeners into the conversation. What are your questions about the science of memory manipulation? And would you ever do it? Erase, implant, or change a memory if you could? What hopes do you have for these types of tools and abilities? What concerns do you have about it? You can tell us by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, sharing your thoughts on our social channels, Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads, or by emailing forum@kqed.org. Stepping back a little bit, Steve, can you just tell us how important our memories are to who we are and how we act, because you've called it nothing less than the perpetual beating heart of life.
Yeah, to me, memory is simply what the brain does. And it's really amazing that no matter where you look in nature, whether it's algae or some single cell organism, or you scale up to, let's say, fruit flies, or you continue going up the evolutionary tree here to rodents, or to dogs, our pets, rabbits, humans, non-human primates, and so on, that in everywhere you see biology, you see memory. You see an organism trying to soak up whatever it's experiencing, turning that experience into some kind of biologically meaningful change in their bodies and in their brains and their nervous system, and then later accessing those changes to bring that memory back to life, presumably to now make some decision in the environment, right? Where to go to eat, what to avoid, and so on. So memory is this thing that you find everywhere in nature. And for me, it's not a coincidence that we have to be sponges that absorb and are sculpted by experience so that we can later access that experience to make some adaptive, presumably, decisions in the world. And I think I really think it's the beating heart of life, because memories, for humans at least, it's the thing that threads and unifies our overall sense of being, our identity. The who we are today is the sum total of all the memories and all the experiences we've had up to this point in our lifetime that have sculpted away that sculpture that we are today, kind of thing. So for me, no matter where we look in biology, memory is at the center of what makes an organism tick. And for humans, it's the very thing that gives us our sense of self and our sense of identity over time. And we know that all too well, because in its absence, a lot of those features now begin becoming pretty dramatically impaired rather quickly.
Can I ask you what it was like when you realized those initial mouse experiments worked, that you were able to activate a memory and essentially implant a memory in a mouse's brain in a space that it had not been before?
I was both beside myself, but like wildly nervous as a grad student, because I was relying on Shu to be my mini echo chamber here. And I didn't really know how excited I should or shouldn't be, because this was my first year as a grad student and at MIT, where I already had this like doom and gloom feeling of like, what am I doing here? Like, did I accidentally, someone in admissions got this wrong. Like, I don't know why I'm here, but let me just get to work and do the thing that I enjoy doing. So when those experiments worked, I thought, I want to jump up and down, because it was as black and white as an experiment could possibly get. But Shu was very laser focused and didn't really emote, to be honest, during those experiments, and was just looking with like just razor sharp focus at what the animals were doing. And it wasn't until afterwards where I asked him, like, so that definitely just worked, right? And then that's when he confirmed that it had worked, and then made a laundry list of follow-up experiments that we had to do to really nail this down. So inwardly, I wanted to just frantically go up and down and just be to the moon and back in excitement. But I had to suppress a lot of that, because I didn't know if it was appropriate in that moment to celebrate an experiment just yet.
That was very characteristic of Shu, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. He was definitely like, you know, I say that I sometimes tend to say in a million words what I probably could have said in 100, and Shu's the opposite, where he reserves all of his words to be purposeful and to actually have some kind of object or goal in mind. And I appreciated and learned so much of that disciplined way of thinking from him, because he would actually think before he spoke, and I just really admired that, because that means that everything that he said to me had some kind of purpose behind it. So I enjoyed that. We were very complimentary in that sense of a dynamic duo together.
We're talking with neuroscientist Steve Ramirez, associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Boston University. His new book is called How to Change a Memory, One Neuroscientist's Quest to Alter the Past. And we'll have more with him and you after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
The Forum rebroadcast continues. Support for KQED comes from the Museum of Craft and Design. Visitors are invited to step into Judith Schechter's Supernatural, an 8-foot stained glass dome where beauty, nature, and imagination converge. Learn more at sfm.org. cd.org.
On the next Climate One, religion can be a powerful force to drive human action, including on the climate.
There is so much that faith communities and faith leaders contribute to confronting the climate crisis and to the climate movement more broadly.
Faith and Climate Progress on the next Climate One.
And that begins after Forum wraps up at 10 o'clock on KQED News. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51 AFL-CIO. Now the Forum rebroadcast continues on a Monday night at 9:20 KQED News.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the science of memory manipulation, which has gone quite a bit farther than I realized before I prepped for this show. In groundbreaking experiments with mice, neuroscientist Steve Ramirez, along with his late lab partner Shu Lu, succeeded in turning specific memories on and off, as well as implanting new or false ones. And Ramirez says someday we'll be able to do the same with humans, someday not too far off. And listeners, you are also joining your conversation, the conversation with your questions about the science of memory manipulation and whether you would ever do it and the hopes you have for such tools or abilities or concerns that you have about them at the email address forum at kqed.org, finding us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at KQED Forum, or by calling 866-733-6786. And Noel on Discord writes, I could see this memory manipulation being helpful to treat PTSD, which is something that Steve has thought about a lot. Steve, I do want to ask you a little bit more about your work with your lab partner and mentor at MIT, Shu Lu. You were talking about how he was, you know, sort of reserved and careful about his experiments and quiet about his celebrations of it. You've described him as kind-hearted, like a big brother, very, very perceptive. And I think one of the examples was just that I could see it was just in the way that Shu would treat the mice that he was working with. Can you just describe a little bit about how he approached the mice?
Yeah, he really taught me firsthand how to approach our science in general, and then the heroes of our science, which is the mice that we work with such respect and veneration. Like he really had this deeper respect for life, like for what life is in its presence, and of course, like a respect for what it is in its absence. And I was just really, I found it really admirable the way he approached the mice in lab, because his calm perceptiveness and like almost like this kind of tranquility that he brought to the table made it so that when he was working with the mice, there was this two-way street of respect here when they were together. So, I mean, I remember when he was teaching me how to scoop up a mouse in a really gentle, friendly, you're not trying to scare them at all kind of way. And if anything, you're trying to build this kind of trust because you're about to embark on experiments that can take weeks at end kind of thing. And he approached them with this kind of sort of zen-like tranquility. And I could tell that they responded to it because the way that he would scoop them up, the mice seemed pretty fearless around him. And if anything, also very docile and calm. When I first was learning this, I think I was as freaked out as my own mice were at that time. So I really had to learn, you know, this sort of, it's like the scene in How to Train a Dragon on how to tame your pet. I think it was the same thing here, except in this case, it was experimental subjects and trying to establish this kind of sort of healthy, gentle calmness so that we could perform our experiments without any hiccups happening along the way.
So Shu died suddenly in 2015. What effect did his death have on you?
It was the most heartbreaking thing I've ever went through and the hardest thing I ever went through, just because of how close we were, but how much I really imagined our future together that now could no longer be the case. I mean, growing up, I had, you know, I'd unfortunately lost friends and family members and had been certainly not the idea of death wasn't a foreign one. Like it was something that I had thought about kind of frequently. And with Shu, it just felt really different because when I started in grad school, he was that kind of big brother in lab that I immediately latched onto. And we just had such an organic dynamic duo together. We even agreed, like the very first day we met, we hit it off in conversation and we agreed let's just give all of our interviews and poster presentations and science presentations at seminars or invited talks, our papers even, let's make them all co-first author so that me and him split the credit 50-50, and let's do all of this together and we'll split it right down the middle 50-50, because we had this kind of 1+1=3 mentality. So I was just enamored. Like I felt safe, to be honest. Like I felt really safe in science, which is a really difficult feeling to feel in a somewhat tumultuous and in a field where the unknown is the day-to-day grind that we end up embarking on. So I had imagined so much of our time together, of starting our labs together, having excuses to visit each other at our respective universities, bringing our labs, going out to dinners, going to conferences together, collaborating since we began in 2010 all the way to our final collaboration before retirement. Like I just had this whole vision in my head of what a successful and happy career could look like with him. And I was enchanting. Like everything about it just made me just over the moon about being able to work together. So when he passed, all of that immediately crumbled down. And that, I think, crumbled down with the kind of weight that really, it really breaks a person, because I hadn't wrestled with that kind of loss at that level. And then forfeiting a future that couldn't be possible anymore all in one. So the whiplash of that was the kind of thing that took, to be honest, I mean, it took almost a decade of really doing some soul searching and trying to now understand what my different future means to me and what it means to embark on that future with only the memory of a friend now rather than a friend here in another physical form.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that, Steve. I'm so sorry for that loss. I understand that just the intensity of that grief also gave you new insights into the strong emotional weight that memories do carry.
Yeah, exactly. The strong emotional weight that memories carry was something that I learned up close and personal after Shu's passing, because it was as if all of the future that I had built in my head together was built on these blocks of memories of all of our times together and all of our laughs together and scientific collaborations together. And when that came crashing down, the weight of those memories, at first it imbued me with a kind of terror, like a genuine feeling of being scared and uncontrollably so, because I no longer knew what my future entailed, and I no longer knew how our work was going to move forward, where I had to sort of carry the flag here, so to speak. And I didn't know how to do that. So I was lost in this world of I don't know. Mortality on its own was a topic that now I began perseverating on and thinking about again and again, because there's this inherent unfairness, it feels like, that we are all in the process of becoming memories in one way or another. And that was scary. Like that was really scary. That was the kind of thing that it reminded me that I want to make sense of this for the short amount of time I have here on Earth. Like I want to understand this and what, why, and like, is there, can I find some deeper sense of purpose or reason or meaning or so on? And doing so made me travel through all of the memories that I've either wrote about, or memories that at first I kind of kept at an arm's length, because it was difficult to think of mine and Shu's happy times together when he was no longer here. But ultimately, through that process, that deeper sense of purpose that I was looking for, I realized was something that came about when recalling these memories and presumably inadvertently changing some of these memories, which was that what they mean to me really changed over time. Like the first day that I met Shu all the way to the last words that we had together, what those things mean to me now have changed in the past decade, really. And they've changed to have a deeper sense of purpose. Like I think I'm just infinitely more of a gratitude filled person nowadays. And I think of my memory of Shu as providential, and all the things that he taught me and all the lessons he taught me, they live in me. And I'm so, just on a deeply personal level, proud as a human being to be able to carry that torch of our memory research, as well as all of the life lessons that I learned by having such a humble, disciplined, loyal, brilliant, scholarly partner by my side. So bittersweet, to say the least, but the kinds of things that, or the kinds of things that in the last decade I felt like I've been able to unpack one by one after kind of clawing out of an emotional rock bottom and then trying to figure out, okay, what can I do with the life that I have and the memories of my friend that I have with me? Because they're not nothing. And if I can imbue with them an added sense of purpose and share them with the world, ideally in a way that might even help or connect with someone, then it feels like I'm doing something that's of value.
Well, Catherine writes, while I was interviewing Holocaust survivors, I noticed that the more they tried to forget their trauma, the more they seemed to remember. How does Mr. Ramirez approach trauma and healing?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I approach it, of course, from a memory-centric perspective, where I think of traumatic experiences, and the science now thinks of traumatic experiences as these events that leave a permanent, indelible change in the brain. And whereas a lot of the changes that happen in our brains in our day-to-day lives, like when we're driving down the street, heading to work, eating breakfast, are pretty inconsequential. We forget about them soon afterwards, and then we carry on with our days. A traumatic experience, one of the core features is that perseverating. It is that remembering that experience again and again, and unwillingly so, that it's almost like there's world triggers that can bring those memory back, or internal triggers that bring those memories back. And I think that it's one of the things that highlights how powerful memories can be, because in one memory, if I think of the best day of my life, or in a second memory, if I think about the worst day of my life, the first memory can make me euphoric, put me in a good mood. There's some science to suggest that thinking of positive memories even increases our cognitive flexibility and sociability and so on. Negative memories, and particularly traumatic memories, do the opposite, where we feel stuck in place, our heart rate goes up, we begin sweating a bit more, we certainly aren't more sociable, our mood tanks and so on. So what it is about those memories and why they have that paralyzing effect is, I think, not only a testament to how powerful memory actually is, given that it can kind of make us feel euphoric or somber and stuck in place within just a few seconds. So what's happening in those few seconds and beyond is the kind of stuff that we're trying to figure out in the lab. Like, what makes some particularly negative memory more sticky in the brain? What happens when those cells are constantly active, even when they shouldn't be? And then how does that now begin to spread almost like a venom throughout the brain that then begins to have these paralyzing effects on an entire organism? There's some great theories out there as to what's happening, but I'd say that, you know, the jury's still out there in terms of how to treat those kinds of memories in a way that I think would be what people would be looking for, which is normally to think about it as, many people would report wanting, of course, to alleviate the traumatic components of a memory, but not necessarily to forget the entire thing, or not at the expense of removing a part of their identity even. And I think that maybe the short summary of where we are in 2025 is that there are ways of going into the brain and chiseling out the emotional components of a memory while leaving the memory of what happened intact, if that is what we choose to do. And in mice, we can go in and find them at the level of individual brain cells to try to remove out, or to try to cut out, the traumatic components of a memory while leaving the event of what happened actually still intact. So presumably our identity doesn't take too much of a hit as a result.
Wow. Well, let me go to caller Kayvon in Claremont. Hi, Kayvon. You're on.
Hello. Hi, thank you. As a psychotherapist and also as a Baha'i, I see difficulties and hardships in life as an opportunity rather than a punishment to conquer ourselves, to fight ourselves, to develop new muscles. Also, I know almost all religions, after somebody dies, they pray for them, believing that they are on an ongoing journey of soul towards God, and they take their memories with them. And I'm assuming that we will not feel the same way towards those events that happen in our lives the way that we did in this world, believing that there are many worlds of God. So I'm thinking, if they deprive a person of the ability to conquer themselves, you know, test our stumbling blocks or stepping stones as we make them. Then also in the next.
You mean the importance of memories in that process, Kayvon, of testing ourselves and so on, and to being stronger?
Especially memories, were memories of difficulties, basically. Difficulties in life are here to make us feel humble, to make us feel...
Yes.
And all of those benefits, and then conquering ourselves to grow.
And so the benefits of not weakening those. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Kayvon, but we have a couple of other comments, I think, along similar lines, like Grace on Discord, who writes, call me irrational, but the idea of altering memory sounds terrifying. It's like that moment in Eternal Sunshine when Jim Carrey's character realizes he wants to hold on to the memories of his relationship. I've had a lot of traumatic experiences in the past, but looking back at them today, they've been milestones to show how much I've grown over time from some of the lowest points of my life. Even for you, Steve, I understand that with everything that you went through with your grief over Shu's death, even at one point trying to sort of blunt the emotional impact of them with alcohol and so on, that am I right that you ultimately landed on the fact that it is very important for us to keep our painful memories?
Yes. And I think this is summarizing a subset of psychological research that suggests that in order to be happy, you have to first lose happiness. And that's a brutal reality in this case. And of course, when Shu passed, I noticed that I certainly didn't want our memories changed. I didn't want my memories changed of him. When I slowly started to drink more and more afterwards, I realized that what I was doing was I wasn't necessarily trying to numb anything. It's that some of these memories that I would recall just didn't make sense. And it was just, it was difficult to recall memories of someone that is no longer here. And I wanted to try to find out why. Like I wanted to understand. I know that it feels difficult, but when I drank, it made it easier to navigate those memories and to try to extract whatever kernel of wisdom might exist in them. So the irony here was that drinking was temptingly one of the best things that helped me recall these more difficult memories.
But right, initially, right?
Yeah, it was one of the best things in the most unsustainable way possible. So what I realized here was that it was a kind of a cheat code that is not sustainable, in a way that even though it was helpful psychologically in the moment, it was horrible for the addiction that it became and the life that it almost robbed me of. So the thing there was that what I was wrestling with was with a tremendous amount of grief and pain, and I didn't know how to make sense of it. And alcohol, while it helped to make sense in the moment, it was robbing it, the exchange there was that it was robbing me of my life, and that was not a transaction that I was willing to make. And then over time, the more sustainable ways of really approaching this, of course, was through either therapy or through group meetings in particular, where I learned firsthand, probably the most profound thing I'd learned in this time of my life, was that the opposite of addiction is connection. And those connections are very real, both in the human brain and very real in the connections that I would make with other people in recovery, where I learned here that what I was trying to get with alcohol was slowly deteriorating me, but I could get those kinds of connections of these memories and what they meant to me by going to meetings, by talking to other people, by listening from their lived experiences, and then the same thing in therapy for that matter as well. That combination was so powerful because it taught me very quickly that I had to rebuild myself in a sense after Shu had passed, to seek out communities and to seek out help from people in recovery who were they were my guides in this uncharted territory of my life that I was in at that time.
We're coming up on a break, but you did tell the publication Nautilus that you did think about what it would be like to weaken or erase maybe your painful memory of Shu's death, but only briefly. Is that right?
Yeah, I thought about it, and it was just something that to me, it felt wrong, and I think it would change too much of who I was as a person, so it wasn't worth it. I would rather change the memory to get a different angle on it and extract some new meaning of what it means to me, but not to erase it, because to me, I still, the good and the bad are a part of life, right? And I accept that part.
We're talking about memory manipulation with Steve Ramirez, who's written a book about his work on it, How to Change a Memory. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Coming up tomorrow on Forum, child farm workers. Children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agriculture industry. But they describe unsafe and unsanitary conditions, extreme heat, and a fear of speaking up because they can't afford to lose their jobs. Journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with 61 children who work in the fields in Salinas, Santa Maria, San Joaquin, and Pajaro Valleys. We'll talk to Lopez about the state's lack of regulatory oversight and how it's responding to his reporting. Join us. For past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the personal experiences that affected Steve Ramirez, a neuroscientist and associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Boston University, and his work on memory manipulation and groundbreaking experiments with mice. Ramirez and his late lab partner, Xu Lu, has succeeded in turning specific memories on and off, as well as implanting new or false ones. And he says that we could do this in humans, and we're talking about the ethical concerns that that raises, and also hearing from you, our listeners, about whether you would ever do it or not, why or why not, the hopes you have for such tools and the concerns you have about them as well. We have a couple of comments like this. Steve, Serena writes, this feels like a Pandora's box on par with the atomic bomb. The military, technology companies, and governments will exploit memory alteration. Steve writes, with tremendous respect to Dr. Ramirez, what a dangerous idea. Clearly a case of just because we can doesn't mean we should. The only application in my mind is to treat mental illness, but understanding our imprecise nature as humans and the kind of mistakes we make with new inventions, I'm pessimistic about the success of even this. Painful memories are a part of the human condition, and plastic surgery for the mind will ultimately make us weaker as a species. So, Steve, let's get to this, because this is something you and Xu immediately talked about after you were successful in your experiments. First, what are the ethical concerns around this? How could this be misused?
Yeah, it's a great question, and something that I think we have to take as seriously as the commenter wrote about it, you know, it's akin to the atomic bomb or something like that. That I approach this head on and with full transparency for the ethics and the science that we're doing, because unlike the Manhattan Project, this was something that from day zero, Xu and I were like, let's announce this. Let's talk about it with everyone. Let's be public facing with everyone, because everyone with memory has something at stake here. So just basically the population of Earth. So we approach this head on by saying memory manipulation can be used for good if our goal is to restore health and well-being to a human, to be able to turn up the positive aspects of a positive memory that maybe are impaired due to a psychiatric disorder, for instance, or to turn down the negative emotional oomph of a memory associated with the PTSD that might be debilitating an individual. And what we converged on by thinking about it that way was that we certainly do not want it to be a plastic surgery for the brain. That's a great way of putting it, because that's what we don't want it to be, and at least not now. Like, the way that I'm thinking about this is that we would rather this be a kind of antidote for the brain that can be used with an ethically bounded goal of either promoting health and well-being or restoring health and well-being, not for recreational use so that Steve here can get over a high school breakup that he can't get over. It's like, well, no, I can get over it and move on and build my life in bigger and better directions that doesn't require memory manipulation. But the person that's living with a given disorder that is impaired in any meaningful sense here, functioning in society, impaired in their sleep patterns and day-to-day grind, that's different, because that does require, I think, the careful scalpel of medicine to try and restore health back to the individual. So we thought about it this way, that if memory manipulation is something that we can keep in clinically relevant settings or medical relevant settings, then our ethically bounded goal here is the do no harm approach and the do good approach for the sake of health and well-being in a human. Mm-hmm. I think that at least gives us a little bit of of public-facing seatbelts in this sense, so that it can be part of the broader discussion that we all have collectively, so that nothing is shrouded in secrecy. And it's like a, hey, what do we think? What are all the ways this can go bad? Because there's many. And now what are all the ways that this can go good? You know, I think of this by analogy as when the Model T first came out, and I don't know how many miles per hour it went, but there was a point where cars went at a certain speed where seatbelts certainly became a good thing to have for the sake of preventative, for being a preventative here. And I think of the same way of having these kinds of broader discussions with everybody, and it's like we're doing right now for that matter, as a way of building what are the most, of asking and building the most effective seatbelts that we can for memory manipulation so that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands or is misused.
Well, that's along the lines of Deborah's question. Deborah writes, I'm curious what guardrails are in place or are needed to keep this amazing discovery from causing harm. The success of memory manipulation depends on how it's monetized and how it's regulated. There is a dark side here that is real and needs to be thought out thoroughly. Yeah, I mean, we hear people talking about concerns about people stealing identities or implanting false confessions to crimes or just all kinds of things where the brain can go with regard to concerns about the misuse of this. What guardrails do you know of that are being, that are in place or at least being talked about? I know you just mentioned trying to keep it in clinical settings, but how real is that, Steve?
Yeah, I think some of the guardrails that come to mind here are raising a general awareness to begin with. Like, that's certainly not good enough, but it's a starting point, such as in the court of law, where if you're going to hear eyewitness testimony that is built on memories, that's good, and we need that. Like, we of course need this as a bit of evidence and a standard in the court. But I think it's good to have like a bit of a, almost like of a warning of, it's not that we are not going to believe someone, of course. It's that memories are built on fallible biology, and that we, if whatever, whatever an individual is recounting as part of a testimony, let's do our best to triangulate objective measures that can corroborate that story. Was there a bit of DNA left over? Is there a video recording of what happened? We had multiple accounts and so on and so forth. Because then that way we don't have to exclusively rely on just one bit of biology that can certainly be faulty. And then with regards to its misuse, I think of this as, you know, we researchers here are trying to understand how the most complicated organ in the universe works. So how does the brain work, and how does memory within the brain work? The second that you now start figuring that information out, knowledge can be power. How you use that power, I think, really matters. Mine and Shu's goal and my lab's goal and the researchers that we collaborate and work with worldwide here, our goal is to understand memory and to try to use it for the sake of improving well-being across the board. Now, once you start getting this into a commercial setting, this is where things can get a little sinister pretty quickly, or very sinister pretty quickly, because you may not have to go in and start extracting information from one brain and implanting it in another, or pulling an Inception and trying to steal an idea, or so on and so forth, or an Eternal Sunshine and trying to erase memories and so on. What you can do is, you can just learn pretty quickly that if you play an ad for 3 seconds while you're scrolling through Instagram today, in 3 weeks, you might end up buying a pair of shoes that you think was out of your own agency, but we know it was because you were exposed to that ad 3 weeks ago for an X amount of time, and so on and so forth. So once you start getting companies here that know that we have this what's called a priming effect in the brain, that they can kind of take little bits of information, put it in front of you for a few seconds, and there is a significant amount of people that will end up doing the thing that that little bit of information is nudging them towards, that is dangerous, because that can, if that is a phenomena that happens without any guardrails, except just as the company making more money or not, that's a problem, because then you can really begin swaying entire populations or demographics to, on average, make the choice or decision that you want them to make. I mean, we've figured this out a long time ago, but seeing it in action now through bigger companies or through different aspects of social media or bots and so on and so forth is dangerous. And I think that is unfortunately how memories are being manipulated nowadays, is through the information and the content that we consume, such as on social media. And I honestly wish that there was even more of a outrage and guardrails around that, because that's the thing that's in all of our back pockets and has access to most of humanity.
And we're talking about the ethical questions around memory manipulation with Steve Ramirez and his book, How to Change a Memory. Let me go next to caller Dan in Oakland. Hi, Dan, you're on.
Hi. So I had a fal severe grand mal seizure back in February 2020. And ever since then, I lost all memory of events and activities going before that. So don't remember my wedding, don't remember concerts, don't remember vacations, don't remember anything I ever did with the kids, you know, on and on, my parents' funerals. I lost all that, but I remember some facts, like I remember my address till I was 13 and the next one and how some people looked like in high school, and I'm 72 now. So I don't know if there's anything for that. What I'd really like to have fixed, if it's possible, is now I've realized I have an ongoing thing. Once something's like 6 or 8 months behind me, 80% of that disappears, you know. So like now I forget things from earlier this year, and by mid next year I'll forget things that I did now, and I would like that to be normal.
So, Dan, how are you then reacting to what you're hearing in this conversation? I'm just so curious quickly.
Yeah, well, it's... So I don't really have PTSD, you know. It's just that it's just tough to keep going and losing memory as I go.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting. Even neurologists, you know, that I take anti-seizure meds and all that. But, you know, they're even kind of puzzled because usually they think of long-term memory as hardwired and short-term memory is, you know, what you can lose. But
right.
I lost a ton of long-term.
Dan, thank you for sharing that. And also, you know, can what you're doing help someone like a Dan? Or also, we're getting lots of questions, Steve, from people about, you know, does this research have any potential for leading to a way to reactivate, reinforce, or recall memories lost to time and or dementia or it's Alzheimer's? Paul is asking this question.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Dan, for sharing all of that. I mean, that just like succinctly puts a human face on the why of what we do, of why we do the research that we do. And it's to try to understand that, amnesia that can be produced in many different ways, such as after a grand mal seizure or after a couple of nights of sleep deprivation will produce amnesia. A drug addiction will produce amnesia. Of course, Alzheimer's, the hallmark of it is amnesia. And the one amnesia we all share is infantile amnesia. So the memories that we formed up until we were about 3 years old, we tend not really to remember anymore. So I'll start carefully with why I'm optimistic, but then a bit of a cautionary tale to try not to anthropomorphize too much on our rodent work, or to try not to overextend or oversell, quote unquote, our rodent work. So in rodents, one of the biggest success stories that I've seen in the last decade is the ability to restore memories that were once thought to be lost. It's one of the most amazing things that I've seen in my entire career in neuroscience, because we have animal models of sleep deprivation amnesia. We have animal models of addiction-induced amnesia, as well as cancer-induced amnesia, as well as infantile amnesia and Alzheimer's amnesia. In every single one of those cases, we've been able to successfully restore the memory that was thought to be lost. That, to me, is profound, because that tells me that maybe the brain is really storing a lot more information than we give it credit for, but it just doesn't have to access all of it all the time. And if anything, it's not really great at accessing all of it all the time. And in a particular pathological case, Alzheimer's, a result of seizures and so on and so forth, in every single one of those cases, the memories appear to be gone and there's a very real amnesia that exists. And as we heard, it has a very real human face behind it, which I think is really at center stage of all of this. Now, the rodent work gives us reason to be optimistic, because it is success story after success story of being able to pull memories out of amnesia and to be able to restore them once again. It's a mammalian brain. They share many evolutionary features that are similar to the human brain. So I'd like to think that the work that we're doing in rodents offers a sneak peek of what can be possible in humans, hopefully sooner versus later. So the part where I want to be careful here is that that promise doesn't have to be the case. Like, it might be the case that the human brain has some features that, with regards to memory and its accessibility, that are different than rodents. But because the jury's still out, my gut feeling here is that even in instances where we have amnesia of the past, if we had a good enough either technology or a good enough conceptual framework or psychological framework to work with, we may be able to restore a lot of what was previously thought to be lost. But that's a bit of a mini holy grail in all of memory research that, again, in rodents has been triumphant. The hope is that in humans it will be just as triumphant as well.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum, and I'm Mina Kim. So very quickly then, Steve, what are some of the biggest questions or some of the things that are still needed to sort of complete the quest of memory manipulation for good, right, that still need answering?
Yeah, that's a great question. In short, I think one of the biggest questions in memory research and in neuroscience really is what is the actual physical basis of a memory in the brain? The same way that DNA is the basis of life, what is the DNA of memory in the brain? And we don't know that yet, actually. It's pretty remarkable that we know so much about what correlates of memories look like in the brain, and that we can turn these cells on and off to restore or to suppress memories and so on. But we don't yet know what their DNA here in quotes actually is. Like, we don't know what is the simplest building block needed to make a memory possible in the brain, let alone the kinds of complex memories that we know and have. If we can learn that, if we can learn what this kind of signature, so to speak, of what memory is in the brain, then we're really in business here. Because one of the inconvenient truths is that biology is really unstable. Like, biology is constantly tossing and turning and changing, and cells are constantly being physically modified at any given moment of our waking and unwaking lives. So how is it that a memory is stable and feels stable, even though the biology that makes it possible is anything but stable? I think that's one of the current dilemmas that the field is trying to wrestle with, of how do we get the stability of a memory, but it's built off of shaky biological parts here.
Yeah, and it could be all over the brain, right? Because so many things are interacting to be able to create that memory in the first place. So the other thing that I wanted to ask you too is because, you know, we are continuing to get comments like Vivian's, who says, I feel a little alarmist, but between this memory manipulation and the studies on using AI and MRIs to read thoughts, I can't help but feel like we're opening some very scary boxes. Suzanne says, I'm very afraid of this tech being unleashed, especially in this government climate. And so I'm wondering, is there some official way that the public can weigh in on what's happening with memory manipulation to be able to move it towards the ends that you are hoping for that you can tell us about?
Yeah, the most pragmatic way that I can think about here is to vote in people who are scientifically literate, is to have the people representing and making decisions about science and medicine in the states and in the world be either scientists or doctors that have the decades of training that know that cutting edge of what is truly known and unknown. Because our agenda here is to seek out the truth. Our agenda is to understand, how does the brain work? How does memory work? How can we make all of our lives better by knowing this? We now have a car that can go 200 miles per hour, by analogy, and we're learning that we need seatbelts, and maybe we don't need the car to go 200 miles per hour, and we need speed limits, and we need some oversight here to make sure that we're not speeding here when we shouldn't be when it comes to this research. So I think that the most pragmatic way here is to stay on top of what's happening in the politics around us, and to have a scientifically literate electorate, which I don't think is too much to ask for when it comes to the science that is the very thing that can take us into a healthier and better future. So that's at least my two cents on the matter.
Well, Steve Ramirez, Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Science at Boston University, with the new book, How to Change a Memory, One Neuroscientist's Quest to Alter the Past. Thank you very much for talking with us.
This was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And my thanks to our listeners for raising their questions, concerns, hopes, and fears about this technology and these abilities that Steve has helped unlock. My thanks to Mark Nieto for producing this segment. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
Climate One is on the way next, along with an NPR News update, 10 o'clock on KQED News. I'm Michael Stade in for Sandy Althaus, beginning with a traffic problem in Oakland. An update of traffic now with Joe Salvatore.
Yeah, Michael, this is on eastbound 580 at Fruitvale Avenue. This is a solo crash started by hitting the guardrail. It is now blocking the three right lanes. Emergency crews are on scene. Traffic backed up towards Park Boulevard. And in Castro Valley, westbound 580 at Castro Valley Boulevard, this is a solo crash facing the wrong way on the shoulder. Fire crews blocking the right lane. Joe Salvatore for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Mark Feringer's Nutcracker Suites in person at the Cowell Theater, a magical hour of danced storytelling with live music for children of all ages. And now through the 21st in San Francisco. Tickets at 4.